Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Merry Christmas and a happy new podcast. Strike up the band!
In a motorway service station, and the phone went off, and it was the current Prime Minister at the time, and it was, he just wanted a joke.
You didn't really need any attack lines on IDS because they were supplied by his own side.
Yeah, we ended up making a joke about how David Cameron was a bit like Toilet Duck.
Yes, here we are again then with the Christmas special of How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to a huge political year ahead, looking ahead to 2024. I'm Matt Chorley, still joined by new Labour mastermind Peter Manson, Polly McKenzie, who's Director of Policy for Nick Clegg and the Coalition, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein. You can send in your questions to howtowin@thetimes.co.uk and we'll answer them in the coming weeks. In fact, this whole episode today is going to be answering some of your questions because so many have sent them in. But first of all, happy Christmas, everyone. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas, Christmas, Polly, to you. Happy Hanukkah to you, Danny.
Thank you.
And happy, to be fair, to Ed Miliband, to you, Peter. We've got some Christmas crackers. Here we are, look. So no expense spared.
Oh, God. They're really light, aren't they?
do you want me to pull this myself or to Peter and
you
I?
You can pull it with Peter. Pull it with Peter. Oh, I'll pull it with Polly. Here we are, look. Oh, bang!
Oh, I won both.
There we are. I've won both as well. Very good.
I love that smell of gunpowder in the morning.
Oh, yes, lovely. Put your paper hats on, everyone. Make good way.
Just having a look here.
How have you been celebrating Christmas?
With my mother and my brother. And how many children? I don't know. So many, it's hard to count.
Lovely. Are you a turkey?
I'm not a turkey. I'm a human being.
No, but are you a turkey person?
I am a big fan of turkey. I even like Brussels sprouts, but I like them cooked with bacon and chestnuts.
Yeah.
I can't find the joke in here. How will Davey write his next speech? Well, right, I've got it.
Danny, how do you spend Christmas?
Well, we do get together as a family, but we don't tend to celebrate Christmas, really, because sort of, obviously... We're not Christian.
There we are. Peter?
Oh, be in Wiltshire. with the cattle, the sheep.
Were you creating the nativity?
Yes. I haven't decided what I'm going to bring.
What are you, a wise man, maybe?
You know, bit of myrrh, bit of incense.
Yes.
You know, I haven't quite decided
yet. A baby?
Yet.
Kidnap a baby? Borrow a baby?
No baby being planned.
You never can tell, though.
We've just tied the knot, Peter, this time.
I have tied the knot, and I did actually ask my newly minted husband... whether a baby would be a nice idea, and he gave me a very old-fashioned look. I think he feels I'm a bit past that.
Well, I don't know. You've been cleaning up after other people for a long time. Maybe entirely. So basically, on the podcast today, what we thought we'd do, because we've had so many emails in over the last however long it is, 6, 7, 8 weeks we've been doing How to Win an Election, and we never get through enough of them because we end up eating up all our time. So this is from Ben in Pinner. Do you know Ben, Danny?
There's
more than one person called Ben in Pinner, so this may be one of the Bens that I'd know.
Danny is
maybe,
the king of
maybe
Pinner.
One of the Bens says, that I do not know.
Hi, Matt. I love the different introductions each week, but surely alongside Mastermind Peter and Brainbox Danny, Polly needs a bit more than Head of Policy for Nick Clegg. How about Lib Dem Policy Whiz?
I'm not sure about the word whiz.
You just say all-star? We need a policy star, policy wonk.
They used to say that I was Nick Clegg's brain, which it's a bit like Danny's got that one. And also it's a bit weird because he is in fact, a separate human from me.
Polly McKenzie was Nick Clegg's brain.
But it's creepy, right?
Yeah, it is a bit. Like, so what would you like?
Chubster.
We quite liked Policy McKenzie.
I like Policy McKenzie.
Policy McKenzie is great.
Yeah, Policy. Okay. Ben also says, also, after enjoying listening every week, I now feel very sad. I was too unwell to attend Danny's book event in Pinner for his previous book, and I wish I could have met him. There we are. I think Polly is hilarious. And that's just the end of the letter. And as a new Labour fanboy, I'm in awe of Peter, so perhaps a How to Win an Election roadshow could be on the cards.
I'm willing to go to Pinner.
Well, that's what he does say, come to Pinner first.
I'm certainly
where
willing to go to Pinner.
Where is it?
It's on the road from London to Watford. Oh. So where I live, if you would go out of my house and sort of turn right, you're out of London.
Yeah.
In fact.
We could get a tour bus. Do you fancy that, Peter?
I can't think of anything I'd rather do next in this coming year.
Right.
I mean, are you serious?
Let's get a tour bus. We'll hit the road.
We have to actually do, by the way, those buses that you have in elections there, that we must have that.
Yeah.
You know, the Lib Dem battle bike and all that sort of stuff.
Rishi Sunak travelling exclusively by helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah, those things.
See if he can single-handedly kickstart climate change.
And how the buses are always like a total metaphor. They break down or you double part them. They basically the provider.
Wasn't there a huge row once somebody's tax disc was expired?
Yeah, they were all
on a battle bus.
Oh, that's probably happened loads of times. And then there's the question of where the expenses get logged for a battle bus. Is it constituency spend whilst they're in the constituency? What if it stays? What if it, you know, it's...
Well, there's a whole body episode on
accounting stuff.
Well, that's good. Well, I'm glad we sorted that. We were going to go on the road in 2024. Good. Callum says, love the new podcast about how to win an election. Your panel are very interesting and have a treasure trove of fascinating insights. Please do an episode on long and short campaigns and whether the final weeks and days of an election can really make any difference. Are elections actually won over the course of the previous 4 or 5 years? I'd be interested to know the panelists' thoughts on that. Polly, just explain for us what we mean by the long and short campaign.
Well, the long campaign is what we're doing now, I guess, the slow build-up to an election. The short campaign is usually from the suspension of Parliament when the MPs are no longer MPs, the last sort of 4 weeks, basically, until polling day. And they are regulated differently. There are different spending rules for the long and the short campaign periods.
So what do we think then about, is it all won and just, you know, when the Prime Minister calls the election campaign in the last, 3, 4, 5 weeks of the campaign, does that make any difference? Are there examples in history where an election has changed, or is it all decided?
The famous one was 2017. Hmm. Which had no long campaign because Theresa May surprised everyone by calling it and then didn't show up for the short campaign itself. She was barely visible. She didn't do events. But she didn't do debates. She left the stage to Jeremy Corbyn, who made hay of the whole thing. The vote was basically about Brexit. It was a rerun of the Brexit referendum the year before, and all the pro-Brexit people lined up behind Theresa May, and the Tories' share of the vote went up, and all the anti-Brexits lined up behind Jeremy Corbyn, collapse of Lib Dems, and the Labour share went up as well. So that's what happened in the short campaign, and of course, famously, Theresa lost her majority.
Yeah,
it was a disaster.
Because, although most of that is ascribed to things that Theresa May did, in fact, as you correctly said, Peter, the Tory vote went up. What happened during that campaign was that the anti-Tory vote consolidated. Yeah. Now, whether that was because that was going to happen anyway, or whether it was
during the campaign... No, I think it was over Brexit.
I think
people re-ran the Brexit campaign.
I think that's probably right, and I think also... Oddly, something that I would normally say absolutely did not have any impact because it's too small an issue, which was Tim Farron's positioning of himself on gay rights. I think that did have an effect on pushing people away from the Liberal Democrats, possibly towards Labour at the beginning of the campaign, and consolidating the anti-Tory vote. So much. I also think, by the way, the Daily Mail's headline, which was all about how she was going to put sort of Labour to the sword, effectively, that probably also...
Crush the saboteurs,
that probably also had an effect. So that was a breaching. So I would have, before 2017, I would have answered this question probably quite arrogantly. Of course it makes no difference. It's like three, when people are not following, it doesn't make any difference. The last few years makes all the difference. The economic position, it isn't even campaigning so much. But 2017 does mean you have to pause over that. And I think it was probably the consolidation of the opposition vote during that election.
So I think the 2010 election is another one where actually what happened in those last 4 weeks made a huge difference because of the debates.
Yeah, and suddenly, you know, suddenly Nick Clegg shot out of a hat and there he was.
Well, you know, like the day before that, we were
everyone wanted to agree with Nick.
Yes, but like, why aren't you as famous as Charlie Kennedy?
Exactly.
Blah, 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 blah.
I remember the row about how they'd put Vince Cable on the side of the bus next to Nick Clegg because nobody knew who Nick Clegg was.
Yeah, but nothing changed, did it? I mean,
the Liberal Democrats, at that time was basically a two-party election, which would, I think, in normal circumstances, have crushed the Liberal Democrats because it is a make or break. Do you want to change or do you want to kind of hold on to the Labour Party? And that sort of pincer movement, which would have suppressed the Liberal Democrat vote as it did in 2015, as it did in 2017, was completely kind of exploded by the debates and by the opportunity for people to see there being actually three choices and for Nick Clegg to be charming and charismatic and witty and everyone to accidentally say that they agreed with him. And you know, the Liberal Democrats surged enormously in the polls. That then, in the very last few days, the last 5 or 6 days, started to squeeze back again to that sort of the two-party machine, which is how we ended up with a few fewer seats despite getting 2 million or so more votes. But it did change the election campaign. I genuinely think the Liberal Democrats would have been crushed if it hadn't been for the debate.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm right, but I disagree with that. I mean, that's obviously a perfectly tenable thesis. My alternative to that would be if you look at the polls before the election and on election day, they were pretty much the same. We saw an awful lot of fluctuation in the middle of it, but really in the end, people voted as they were going to vote pretty much at the beginning. We thought the Liberal Democrats would have a breakthrough. In lots of places, they didn't.
They didn't do badly, though.
No, I'm not saying that. Basically, we were going to have hung parliament at the beginning of the election campaign. We ended up with a hung parliament, and the polls were roughly speaking at the end of the campaign
that, because I think the reason we ended up with a hung parliament is partly because of Nick's performance. Everyone wanted to agree with Nick, but also I think Gordon Brown did better in the debates than he had done otherwise during the campaign and during the long campaign. I think the Tories really pummeled him over the financial crisis and public finances and everything. And suddenly they saw in the debates a Gordon Brown who was quite a superior, quite a big guy, big picture person who had managed things fairly well. And I mean, he was furious with me beforehand for agreeing these debates. I had thought they were totally unavoidable. I didn't think we could run away from debates anymore. And it was a breakthrough whose time
I think
had
they
arrived.
Had absolutely no influence whatsoever. Well, and I think people are exactly the same view as they. And I think all that happened was that we, at the beginning of the campaign, we overestimated the chances of the Conservatives having a majority because we underestimated just how big the swing, which may be relevant to this time, by the way. We underestimated how big the swing that was required.
I think we'll come back and
to get the Tories a majority.
But maybe actually the two examples, 2017 and 2010, are sort of connected because, you know, in 2017, there wasn't the Tim Farron surge. You know, he just got squeezed out of it.
But then there was 2015, yeah, which was Miliband versus Cameron. Now, to be fair to Ed Miliband, he'd actually had a very good long campaign on austerity and cost of living and everything. Then when it came to it and people were concentrating, actually I had to make a choice between Cameron and Miliband.
It's that squeeze, Tories did.
They looked at the two and thought, does Miliband square up to Cameron? And they decided not.
I didn't think he did have a good. I thought for a long campaign, it wasn't very good because he didn't concentrate on an issue on which he could win on.
It was better than the short campaign.
No, and he also blamed the Liberal Democrats, which was an odd tactic given that the Conservatives were the larger party and his main enemy.
Well, thank you, Callum, because Callum sent in that question. It's got us talking. Apparently, the mistake in giving you crackers is that you've now got things to fiddle with, which are being picked up by the microphone. So the various bits of paper, I'm not even sure what that is.
It's a spring.
It's just
some
designed
kind
to be fiddled with.
I've got a small notebook.
Yeah, you can't hear it, whatever it is. So just stop fiddling. Well, we'll do some more of the questions that you've emailed in just about here on how to win an election.
you Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is How to Win an Election with Matt Chorley and Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. We are answering some of the questions that you've sent in because we've got so many and it's Christmas. So we thought it'd be nice rather than sending you a Christmas card. If you want to get in touch with questions for 2024, you can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Now, Valentina has been in touch saying, apologies if this comes across as some chippy Scott, but I wonder if parts of the UK that are not England might possibly get an analytical glance now and again. And then it goes on and on and on, but it's all quite chippy. Have we made a mistake in not talking? Because we do, I mean, partly I suppose it's because we are Westminster focused, the parties that fight right across the UK. But actually what's going on in Scotland and Wales is...
But Scotland's going to make or break a Labour majority at the next election, so perhaps we all should focus on it.
Yeah. We did talk at one point about time for change and the fact that it's obviously having an impact on the SNP as well as the Tories, and how therefore it isn't just simply about the issues that the Tories face and the issues the Scots and Nats face, which we tend to look at as if they were discrete. It's something that unites both, and it's the fact they've been in power for a long time. But actually, I always feel a bit diffident about talking about the Scottish election, because I'm kind of very aware that there are lots of cultural elements to that political division that I just don't get. So I think it's probably a fair accusation that I don't include it enough in my analysis.
Yeah, I think Valentina's been chatting to my dad, who lives in Scotland or used to live in Wales.
Is your dad called Valentine?
No.
Very poorly disguised.
But, you know, it is a different dynamic. Northern Ireland is its own really relatively separate kind of political dynamic. I think, you know, we need to look at those probably in depth and separately.
Yeah, we'll come and have a look at that.
You know, the way that the political dynamic, which, you know, Labour used to absolutely dominate Wales and Scotland, and the way that that was lost.
For Labour, it was blown up in Scotland in 2015.
Yeah, exactly.
But here's the point. I think that there's a very important sort of cardinal principle about Labour in Scotland, and that is when Labour loses its way in Westminster, it loses its way in Scotland. The point is that the only point of really voting for Labour in Scotland is if they're doing well enough in England to supply a government in Westminster. And if they're not, and if they're flailing around in England, then Scots will say, what's the point of voting for them here? So you have to do well in England in order to do well in Scotland.
And what about because it was interesting that Keir Starmer now says on the record that he got rid of Richard Leonard in Scotland, because he was the Scottish Labour leader, who said it wasn't very good as part of his sort of 3-point plan, that one clearing out with Scotland. Is there a similar thing going on in Wales? It's been speculated that you know, Mark Drakeford, although he'd said he wouldn't serve, you know, people have broken their promises before about how long they might go on and on and on. But actually, Labour's record in Wales is going to be a stick to beat them with, isn't it, in the general election? You know, schools, the NHS, 20-mile-per-hour zones. You know, is it helpful for Keir Starmer that Mark Drakeford's been got out of the way?
It may or may not be, but I don't think he had anything to do with the decision, certainly nothing that I've heard. All I know is that the, you know, removing Richard Leonard in Scotland paved the way, opened the way for Anna Sawa, who's just a brilliant leader. I mean, he's sort of, you know, he's a clever, smart, funny, dancing, does brilliant dancing videos, very, very attractive indeed. And he's a star, you know, he's box office, Anna Sawa. So anything that opened the way for him was obviously a progressive Labour gain, and that's what's happened.
Okay, well, Vanity, we will come back with that, and maybe we could get a fifth person in the studio who knows about Scottish matters or Welsh matters.
Or we could just put on accents.
Well, that's good. They like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's worthwhile doing it. Doing an episode on it, definitely.
We should do a Wales special, and I will sing Sospan Fach, and then no one will ever tune in again.
And I'll try to pronounce what we now have to call the Brecon Beacons, because it upset loads of listeners last time. Right, here's another one.
Banai Brecheiniog.
Very good. Tim O'Brien says, I've recently come across the podcast and I love it. It's so great to hear people talking who know what they're talking about. I think Tim might have emailed the wrong podcast. He says, but you make it all sound as if politics is a game, albeit deadly. So I'd like to know if you think political principles and philosophy really matter. My view is that politics is the art of the possible, but that you should start with fundamental principles. However, although the public usually see clearly where parties are coming from, too often the parties won't admit where they're coming from for fear of losing too much support. So do we focus too much on the game and not enough on principles?
Well, I let me start by saying that for me, because, you know, I'm the son of immigrants, of refugees, and politics, you know, it killed my grandmother and it exiled my grandfather and it stole everything that we had, every stick of furniture, every piece of crockery. So politics really matters a lot, and it's certainly not a game. I think we do probably correctly concentrate in this on the things that you do that can shift the dial regardless of what you think. But Peter's always been very clear, and I agree with this, that you've got to start with what you believe, and if you can't be authentic, if what you believe is too far from what the electorate think, you're in trouble to start off with. You then, in order to be authentic, you then push yourself out where you can't be voted for.
Yeah, I think her philosophy does matter a lot because it defines you more than anything else. I think that in the country I have a very rough and ready view of the electorate. About half of it is left-leaning and half of it is right-leaning. Sorry to be so unsophisticated. But here's the point. Growing numbers of those left-leaning and right-leaning voters have broken the habit automatically of voting for one party or another. Millions of voters are changing how they vote from one election to another. And, you know, if you're the Labour Party, yes, you know, you're appealing to the left-leaning part of the country. But if you arrive at the mistaken view that actually there's a sort of socialist majority in the country, you know, you're going to be led badly astray. You know, there is not a majority of people in this country who are going to vote for socialism. They will vote with their conscience and they will vote for reform. And that's why the Labour Party has to be a party of conscience and reform. It does have to have a conscience. It has to remember, you know, people in the country who are not so well off, who are disadvantaged and who need a strong government at their side. But if all you're doing is sort of negotiating with your past in the Labour Party, rather than thinking how can you do things differently and better in the future, and not all people in the Labour Party think like that, sorry to take a very New Labour view, you're there. You've got to be both conscience and reform. You know, how you can help the underdog, how you can create opportunities for people who have talent and want to make the most of it for themselves, and what government can do to help them. But you've also got to do government in different ways. And that's the challenge for Labour.
And Polly, what about you? Because you've obviously had the twin experience of inserting yourself into a long-standing political party, mm-hmm. and however that might go against what you actually thought, while also being involved in launching a political party where you can help set its philosophy, if you like.
Politics is absolutely about how you think the country should be run. And that might be by trying to win an election and become the government. And, you know, I think we've talked about this before, but, you know, you win elections in order to run the country. You don't run the country in order to win elections. And if you're putting the cart before the horse, you really are screwing things up if you are putting your party before the interests of the country. But as we saw with UKIP, right, it is possible for a political party to change the conversation in a way that can shift politics and shift the conversation in order to, I guess, push the government, push the dominant political parties to think differently, to act differently, whether for good or ill. And so you don't only need to think about governing as a way of leading social, cultural and political change. But for me, you know, democracy is about how the people choose to be governed. And we think we sometimes, because each individual gets a vote, we imagine that democracy is about me getting what I want. But it's not. You know, a demos is not just people. It is a people, a way of us being together as a collective. And so, as Peter says, you can't try and just govern for one side, govern for your partisan interest. If you become the prime minister, you have to govern for all of the people. And you have to do that with principles, with honesty, and also by, I think, engaging with what all of your people want and would choose, and try and actually build up that sense of who we are, who we are collectively.
That's why I think that Sunak's campaign is going to do badly in the coming year. He's designing a campaign which is all wokey-cokey. It's all about divisions. It's all about inserting divisions.
Why has nobody... I've never heard that before. Wokey-cokey's good.
Peter's just written his first joke.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make a serious point here.
Okay, while wearing a Christmas hat and a festive brooch. But yeah, go on.
Don't say things that rhyme if you're trying to be serious.
Okay, but what would you
Let me say that I do not think that making the boat people and sending 100-odd migrants to Rwanda really is the hill on which Rishi Sunak should be fighting and prepared to die in the coming year. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. I think it's a laughable gimmick. I mean, the only people who are actually laughing are the Rwandans. They're laughing all the way to the bank. They're making so much money out of this ridiculous thing. I mean, by the way, I mean, I know one shouldn't sort of, one doesn't make jokes about illegal immigration. Going back to the discussion we had previously about jokes, I think the fact that Starmer started mocking Sunak over Rwanda at Prime Minister's Questions actually turned the tide on Rwanda.
Is that a joke?
No, it's not. It's not a joke.
Nautical.
But it been, he used humour in order to mock this gimmick. I think then everyone started relaxing. His own side started thinking, what on earth are we doing on this hill? And it, you know, made people feel, God, you know, you're right. And that the election this coming year has to be about a whole range of issues which are much bigger than small boats.
Yeah. Well, we'll wait and see, because we'll obviously have plenty to discuss next year. So what I thought we'd do, as it's our Christmas episode, we've had lots of emails being sent in, but I thought, why don't we get you to ask each other questions? The burning issues that you've wanted to get to the bottom of. Polly, who do you want to ask a question of first?
I want to ask Peter why the Labour Party is so rubbish at having women leaders?
It's a very, very good question. I mean, we're very good at having acting women leaders. Margaret Beckett was stood in when John Smith tragically died. Harriet Harman was acting leader when Ed Miliband sort of disappeared. So we're good at having acting ones. We're not so good at electing them in the first case.
Is it sexism?
No, it's not sexism. It's sort of luck of the draw, really. It's who comes out of that draw and who's available and, you know, who they've got behind them and et cetera.
No, it's a genuine question. It's whether or not maybe, and this is slightly broad brushy, but, you know, is there something about it being born out of the quite male-dominated union movement that is sort of locked in this idea of...
I don't think so. We've got both the leaders of the biggest trade unions in the country are women. Of Unison and Unite.
You know, but it can't just be luck, right? Like, if the Conservative Party have managed three female prime ministers and the Labour Party's never managed to elect a
there was nothing lucky about Liz Truss, you're quite right.
Although, to be fair, the Lib Dems only had one.
Oh, the Lib Dems are rubbish too. I mean, I accept that.
Is it what? Where does that come from?
They've never had a single prime minister, so
it's much harder.
Despite
for the
one woman you had,
it's much harder for the Liberal Democrats because the party's got a smaller base from which to elect any leader. So they're much more. You know, it's much more sort of based on who on earth can be leader, because not that many people can be leader. So I think it is harder for the Liberal Democrats than for Labour.
Easier for the Women's Equality Party.
Yes, but unlikely to win a general election, I think,
at this
in
stage.
The next few years.
But there was
at the same time, you know, just thinking of the Labour Party, alongside Keir Starmer, are two very powerful women, Rachel Reeves and Angela Rayner. I mean, they will be very prominent, both of them, in come the election campaign.
I really enjoyed the preposterous briefing a few weeks ago where Rishi Sunak was going to make Claire Coutinho Chancellor just to annoy Keir Starmer, because then Rachel Reeves wouldn't be the first female Chancellor. I just thought, if that's the level they're operating
well,
on.
Well, there's a lot of sort of inside the Westminster bubble, Beltway, people surrounding Sunak who think of little else.
But, yeah. Yeah. Danny, who would you like to ask a question of?
I shall ask both of you a question to which I do not know the answer myself, so it's not a gotcha question. Did Keir Starmer make an error serving Jeremy Corbyn in his cabinet, or was it necessary for all that follows? In other words,
very, very good question.
It's a very difficult question.
No, so, I said it's a very good question. Yeah. I don't think it's difficult at all, because if we hadn't had Keir Starmer, you know, putting up with Corbyn during all that nonsense and sticking to it and going through, he would, in my view, not have been elected leader of the Labour Party, and we would have got.
Would you have said?
I didn't want to be leader, and nobody expected that. The truth is that if Keir hadn't been there, and if he hadn't been able to present himself as somebody who had stuck through these hard times, I think the party. There was a big risk of the party voting for a Corbynista successor, Rebecca Long-Bailey, instead. And that would have been curtains for the Labour Party.
I don't know what you
curtains for the Labour Party if Keir Starmer had not won in 2019 and if he hadn't now turned round the Labour Party in the way that he has.
I've never understood the sort of the tribalism of the Labour Party sort of properly, or the way that it seems to look like and feel like from inside, the extent of the, I don't know, the resentments.
It wasn't factionalism about, it was disgust about Corbyn. It wasn't factionalism.
But there is also factionalism. It's part of, I think, who the party...
Unlike the Tory party with their five families.
We're not talking about the Conservative Party right now. But it seems to me that after a period of enormous division and conflict for the Labour Party, as Peter says, having had him, Starmer, inside the Corbyn tent, has enabled him to actually pull that party together enough... that it can feel like a relatively coherent force, even whilst he sort of expels the Corbynista faction as much as he can. I think he's, you know, it's so important for him to correct the mistakes of that Corbyn era, particularly around anti-Semitism. And he's done that. He's had to do that quite viciously because he was associated with in the past.
I think it's more than that. I think he was almost unusual in that shadow cabinet in saying nothing about it. So even like John McDonnell would criticise some of the anti-Semitism.
Yeah, he did a little bit, to be fair.
I mean,
actually,
but not very much. I mean, not like it was, because I remember interviewing about it and trying to get anything out of him. It wasn't just that he was in the shadow cabinet. There were lots of people in the shadow cabinet.
That's why I asked this question. I mean, it's difficult, right? So one of the ways in which he attained the position he had in the leadership election, which was the kind of middle person in the party that the Corbynistas could vote for, is precisely because he held this position. You know, and of course, if you jump merely to the fact that this then helped him win the leadership and helping him win the leadership was a good thing, then that's obviously a correct decision. But it also nearly drowned the Labour Party because he supported Corbyn in office. In other words, he helped Corbyn's leadership and at general election told people to vote for Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. So I'm being quite genuine when I say the reason why this is important is because obviously this goes for everybody who has to consider the question of whether or not to stay in something, to be in the leadership team of something which they don't fully believe in, right? And that is a question for absolutely everybody in politics that he is exemplified. And so therefore, if we're saying it was acceptable, you're saying, we are saying, that it's acceptable to be involved in this kind of effectively a sort of deception.
Danny, I think it was a very pragmatic judgment on his
part. But I suppose
there's
a question about how bad would Jeremy Corbyn have had to have been for Keir Starmer to say enough is enough? Because I think to lots of people it got bad enough. But it clearly did. People left the party over it.
Peter, you're assuming that Keir Starmer's politics at that time was the same as it is now. I have a different view of it. I think that Keir Starmer is somebody who's not been all his life like super concentrated on where he is factionally, where he is in terms of the Labour Party, and had to do that as leader and has shifted his position, that he spent almost his whole career actually to the left of people like you and Tony Blair and Neil Kinnock and certainly Gordon Brown and he has then taken over. He then followed that through with Jeremy Corbyn, because he was actually on the left, and then as leader of the party, he's realised that position is not a particularly practical one, and he can't get elected from it, and he's not sure he thinks it's right anymore now that he's an intelligent guy and he can see the issues coming in to him. So I think he has shifted his position.
I don't really agree with that. I think that Keir Starmer has had to think about a lot of policy issues which didn't previously confront him.
Yeah.
He only came into frontline politics in 2015. And for me, I mean, look, he's got no ideological hang-ups about the economy and about business. He's a sort of partnership guy. He knows that you need flourishing businesses in order to create jobs and grow the economy, and he'd never think of any sort of economy in which you didn't sort of team up with business in order to advance the country's economic interest. And on national security and defence, where, you know, he has broken with Corbyn in the most sort of dramatic way, Corbyn, who wasn't even pro-West, wasn't pro-NATO.
Yeah,
he gave the benefit of the doubt whenever he could to Putin and Russia.
Why he spent so now, long in the
he is cabinet. He is somebody who is not wobbly on defence and national security. So that's not new. I think that's something he's found inside him, but he's never been confronted with these issues before.
Okay, let's move on, because you need to make sure that you get your chance, Peter. What is your question you'd like to ask? And is it about Ed Miliband?
It's not about Ed Miliband. I've got a question for Danny, first of all, and that is, how would you advise Rishi Sunak if Nigel Farage applied for membership of the Conservative Party?
That's a good question. So I don't believe a Farageist Conservative Party can work. I don't think it would be stable, and I don't think it would win elections. So there are two parts to this. The first of all is, do I wish to be myself a member of a political party in which he's a member? And the answer to that is I do not. His politics are quite distinct from mine. But the second,
so you would leave, would you?
I guess. I guess I probably would. It's difficult to tell. That would be my working assumption. A lot would depend on the reaction of people to it and what position he took and how far he'd moved his politics in order to accept this. But if it was essentially a reverse takeover of his type of politics, I think it would be very difficult. And I think a lot of other people would react like me. I'm not going to answer an if question, but that would be my working assumption, absolutely. The sort of second part of it is, would it be in itself a stable, is the populist position a stable position for a broad-based Conservative Party? Could it be as successful in the next 100 years as it's been in the last 100 years? And I think it will not be. I've always think trying to sack your old voters and replace them with new ones is a really difficult manoeuvre to pull off. And I don't think it's... I think that it would produce a party which simultaneously had a kind of libertarian leadership and a security-minded electorate. And I think it's a problem enough for any Conservative Party, but it would become very severe with him in the leadership.
Yeah, I've got a question for Polly. And that is, if you were advising Ed Davey in the event of a hung parliament, Labour or Tory sort of minority-led hung parliament, what would you advise Ed Davey should be his biggest ask or condition for his support?
So I don't think they should go for any kind of coalition or possibly even no sort of formal deal either. I don't think Keir Starmer would offer one. I think he'd just bluster his way as a minority government if he had to. I think the Liberal Democrats have to focus on an issue, and ideally an issue that is not the electoral system. I think that, and not because
so
I
not electoral reform.
I massively care about it, and I believe in it, and I think that our entire democratic system is just rubbish. But how do you build up a position in which you can look like you care about what people care about instead of caring about your own interests? And that's
so
the
what's the most important thing to the Liberal Dems, do you think, to Ed Davey?
Well, I would worry that they would do something to stop anybody building any houses, because in their immediate electoral interest, kind of recapturing that sort of the commuter belt outside London is incredibly important to them. I would want them to think about pushing Labour around green investment and green growth, because that is an area where we know that actually, you know, there's plenty of support for that within the Labour Party, but there's also a lot of concern about fiscal positioning, concern about how to do that. And in the end,
to be fair to Ed Miliband, there are plenty of takers for that. mean,
ally with Ed Miliband. But, you know, let's just remember that, like, I'm much better at policy than politics. What would actually win them some more votes? God only knows.
More big stunts. Well, finally then, before we round off for the last one in 2023, I want to ask you all a question. You need to give me two names of the answers. Who is in Downing Street and then who will be in the White House? Who's going to win? Who's going to be the Prime Minister this time next year? And who's going to win the US election next year?
Rishi Sunak will still be the Prime Minister because they won't have called the election.
Oh, of course, because you're very much in January. Although by this point, they will have had to have done.
Yeah, but still technically be
okay,
the Prime Minister.
Okay, so he's still the Prime Minister. Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
so you're still saying...
might not, he'll be in a helicopter somewhere.
Off we go over. So on Boxing Day. He'll be in... Is it Father Christmas? No,
Rishi Sunak, by next January, will be in California. He's not going to be even in this country. he's a tech bro.
So go on then, finish the... So Rishi Sunak is still there because we haven't had the election yet. Who's US President?
Well, I mean, also still Biden because the inauguration.
So who wins the election?
Sorry.
Pedant. Blood out of
I used
the
to have
stone,
a T-shirt that said Polly McKenzie, pedant and proud.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to go...
Yeah, that's the new intro.
I still think it will be Biden.
Biden. Interesting. Danny?
Yeah, so I think I'm virtually certain they'll have had an election by then. And that therefore Keir Starmer will be Prime Minister because the Conservatives will not win a majority. And without that, they will not be... provide the Prime Minister, and I think the American election is extremely difficult to call, so therefore it's not 100% probability, but I think Donald Trump is more likely than not to win it, but it's pretty narrow.
Peter?
I think predictions like that are very dangerous for Labour. Shoo-in elections, basically they say to the electorate, you don't matter, we've taken your vote for granted already. And secondly, it says to the Labour Party, you don't have to change everything because you've won already, so just leave the barnacles there attached to the boat, and it's all very dangerous. So I'm not going to predict that Keir Starmer will be Prime Minister this time.
You think he could lose?
Because I hate shoo-ins and I...
Peter Wilson warns Keir Starmer could lose.
I hate taking anyone for granted. a lot done, a lot still to do.
Okay, what about the US president?
American president, I'm really less sure about.
Less sure than that? Less sure than not answering the question.
No, I'm sure about what Labour has to do to win a majority the next election.
Oh,
don't
I was
worry.
A politician, I was
but
a politician.
I am really, really worried about the American election. I think it could be Trump. And that will be a death blow, in my view, to everything we stand for and do and defend and try to advance in the world. All of us in the West, I think it would be an abject disaster. He'd be off the leash. There'd be nothing to stop him. He'd be surrounded by cleverer people than he was the first time round. And he'd be absolutely determined to completely upset the constitutional apple cart in the United States. And that's going to send ramifications to us all.
What a cheery note to end on in this festive special. It's my fault for asking the question. Well, I hope you all have a lovely break. I look forward to having you back in 2024 because it's going to be absolutely massive. Somebody did email in, actually, which we will touch on again. That there are, is it half the people in the world are going to vote next year? I think is the stat. There are lots of numbers around. Anyway, it's a very large number. There
European
are a lot of
elections. Parliament
elections. European Parliament elections.
Britain, America, and much besides.
And much besides. So we'll look at all of those at various points. And yes, we'll talk more about Scotland and Wales. And possibly even Northern Ireland. But thank you. It's been really fun so far.
Thank you, Matt.
I'm looking forward to the rest of the year. So happy Christmas, happy New Year. Peter Manson, Daniel Finkstein, Polly McKenzie. If you want to get in touch with us with your own questions, email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. That was your Christmas special of How to Win an Election.